Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, a talk about adoption and foster care. Today, we're going to be talking about an introduction to attachment, kind of an everything you ever wanted to know about attachment, but were afraid to ask. But before we get started on that, I just want to take a moment to acknowledge that I know that we are living in a crazy time right now. And I just wanted to acknowledge that I know people are afraid and I feel for you, but you're not alone. And reach out. We've got so many resources on our site. Use this opportunity to learn more and to delve deeper into what makes our kiddos tick. You're going to be around them a lot right now, so this gives us the opportunity. We have so many resources on our website, free to you, creatingafamily.org. Hover over the word, just click on adoption, then click on A to Z resources. And we use every media you could be interested in. We've got audios, we've got video, we've got lots of written materials, tip sheets, fact sheets, blogs, articles, you name it, we've got it there. We also have our Facebook support group, and we're really rallying over there. We're sharing funnies, we're sharing struggles, we're supporting each other. So consider joining us over there, and that is facebook.com/groups/creatingafamily. Hang in there. We are there for you. Feel free to reach out to us. We are all, everybody on our team is involved in the Facebook group, so you can reach us. You can reach us over there, and we want to be able to help you. So don't forget about that. All right. Today we're going to be talking about attachment. We're doing an introduction to attachment. Our guest today is Dr. Casey Call. She is the Assistant Director of Education at the Institute of Child Development at TCU. Her responsibilities include research, training, and outreach connected to the trust-based relationship intervention, which was pioneered by the late, great Dr. Karen Purvis. She also serves as the director of the Hope Connection Camp, and she has her PhD in developmental psychology and has worked closely with both Dr. Karen Purvis as well as Dr. David Cross. Welcome, Dr. Casey McCall, to Creating a Family. I am so glad you could join us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Dawn. I'm excited to be here today.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk. This is, we're assuming that people, even though we know most people have some idea about attachment, we want to start really at the beginning. So what is attachment? And quite frankly, why are we hearing so much about it? Why is it important to a child's development?
Attachment is really just the relationship that we have with our primary caregiver or caregivers that begins it can begin prenatally or from the first moment that we meet. I think the reason that it's so important, there's two things that really stick out to me. One is that your early relationships kind of provide the roadmap for your future relationships. And so attachment becomes important because it sets the stage or kind of builds the scaffolding for all of your future relationships. So peer relationships, marriage relationships, work relationships, and it also helps our bodies and our brains learn how to regulate.
Yeah, so really vital for every aspect of our life.
Yes.
How does attachment develop in kids who are raised from infancy in a healthy, functioning family? I guess what I'm really asking is, what does healthy attachment look like, and how does it develop?
Yeah, so I always joke with my students that they've been in a lot of developmental classes, and they've, you know, memorized Erickson's psychosocial stages of development, and they always learn that from ages 0 to 1, it's the time of trust versus mistrust. And so we really dive into that and how does a child learn how to trust? And we look at it, at the Institute, we have what we've labeled the attachment cycle. And basically what it says is that, a baby will cry because they have a need. They might be hungry or tired or sick or bored or cold. And then, you know, their body is in distress during that time. And then when a caregiver comes to meet that need, then they receive comfort. So then they, you know, their body is calm and they have their need met. So they're getting these little needs met over and over and over again, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of times, as anyone with a new baby can tell you, right? They have needs constantly. And so they're getting these needs met. And what happens is they begin to develop trust, because they, when they cry, you come. And so that's how the trust versus mistrust really kind of plays itself out. And that's how attachment develops. It's Dr. Purvis used to always say, it's the saying yes. And we're saying, yes, I'm going to meet your needs. And yes, I'm going to take care of you. And yes, you can count on me. And so out of that, they develop a sense of trust that someone else is going to help meet their needs. But then they also develop a sense of self-worth, because the baby begins to believe that I'm important, I matter. And then they also learn, they develop their voice, which is self-efficacy. When I cry, you come. And so I have some effect over my environment. And these are the lessons that, you know, in an optimal caregiving situation, babies will learn within their first year of life.
Yeah, nothing is more eerie and unsettling than to either witness yourself or see videos of children in cribs with needs who are not crying. And they have learned that crying is ineffective, that they are not important, that they cannot trust. And it is heartbreaking.
Yes, they've lost their voice. It is the most heartbreaking.
So what events, we just described one of them, but what events can interrupt the normal development of healthy attachment? One, as we just described, being raised in an institution where your needs are not met. You're one of many, and your individual needs are not important. So that's one. But let's talk about some other events that can interrupt normal attachment development.
So another one that we deal with a lot in the child welfare system is multiple caregivers and multiple placements. And so children who are removed from their biological parents and put into a foster or adoptive home, that can disrupt attachment. If you have a caregiver who has trauma of their own that is still not resolved, that can disrupt attachment, as well as a caregiver who maybe has mental health issues or substance abuse issues. It's really just a caregiver who's not meeting needs consistently, warmly, and, you know, on a regular basis.
You mentioned removal. And I think that some people have the idea that any child who is removed from from one home and placed, or one caregiver and placed in the care of another person, that is a disrupted attachment, but that then it will result automatically in a failure to attach again. So if a child has been in a situation where they have been able to form, they were, may not be ideal, but they had formed attachment. What does that predict as far as their ability to form attachment to a new, totally different caregiver?
Well, so babies will form attachment. So it's not a question of if they will form an attachment. I think the question is more, what is the classification of that attachment? So you can have secure attachments or insecure attachments. You can have attachments that are organized or disorganized. So if a child has experience with a caregiver and then is moved and then has a different experience with another caregiver, their attachment classification can change. There was actually a study done by Mary Dozier, I believe, at the University of Delaware, where she looked at babies who had been removed from their biological parents and been placed with in foster care. And I think within about 30 to 90 days, they had taken on the attachment classification of their foster parent.
Oh, interesting. So they reattached, but they attached and their attachment mimicked that of their foster parent. Am I understanding you?
Correct.
Interesting. All right. So what we tell people is that if a child has had a strong, healthy attachment, that bodes well for their ability to form a healthy, strong attachment to you. Is that what you see as well in your research?
Yes, that's exactly right. This is anecdotal. We don't have any research to back this up, but what we have seen through our therapeutic camps is oftentimes children who have been adopted internationally, who have spent time with their biological parents, and then like a tragedy happened, like disease or famine or nutrition, and then they were placed into institutional care and then adopted, they seem to have healthier attachments than children who were, you know, directly placed into orphanage care. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another example would be in certain countries, children, and in the U.S. as well, sometimes children are placed in really strong foster families and given one-on-one attention. And so they come to their new families, and that happens here in the U.S. as well, and it happens in certain countries internationally. So children come, even if they're adopted at the age of one or two, they have been in an environment where they have formed healthy attachments.
Right. Anytime you get a healthy attachment, whether it's in a foster home or with a biological parent or with a surrogate caregiver, I think about it like a garden. You're planting seeds for future healthy relationships.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I always think about, you know, they say that it takes one person to change a life, and that might be a mentor or, you know, an advocate or a teacher or a counselor or someone. And I think that's what you're doing, is you're modeling healthy relationships. And so it can never be, it's always going to be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It will always be helpful. And I love the expression, it only takes one, and it is so true. And I think that's what motivates a lot of us, is to, we hope that we are, may we be the one. Yeah, can we be the one?
Yes.
Can we step up and be the one for that child and really help them? Let me pause for a moment and remind people that this show is underwritten by the Jockey Being Family Foundation. They want you to know that they have a backpack program that is available to all adoption agencies. And if you're a parent listening, you can let your adoption agency know. And in this backpack, there are things both for your child as well as for you. For your child, there is, of course, the backpack itself, which has got the child's initials embroidered on it. There's also a cute little bear and a warm little blanket. But there is also, in addition, a parent tote. And in the parent tote, there are resources available for you as a parent. And they are really useful and very valuable. And it's free. It is their mission to, post-adoption support is their mission. And they want you to know that. So if you're a parent, let your agency know. If you're an agency, you do have to apply as an agency. So it's easy to do. Go to their website, jockeybeingfamily.com. Click on the backpack program. It's super easy, and you can sign up. All right. So we are often in the position of having a child placed in our home, either for adoption or for fostering. And what are some signs? As parents, we know the importance of attachments. So what are some signs that we might look for to note that this child may have attachment issues?
I think one really important one is miscuing. And so when a child has a secure and a healthy attachment, they are going to turn to safe adults to get their needs met. So if you see a child who's having issues with attachment, they may try to one of two things. They might either try to step everything and kind of internalize it and deal with it on their own, not reach out for help, not let you put a band-aid on them when they get hurt, not come to you when they're sick, try to take care of their feelings and emotions and distress on their own. So that would be our internalizer. Or the other way is that they would be externalizer, where they could be really emotionally reactive. It's kind of like they overreact to situations. They might try to keep your attention all the time, and be whiny, I mean, of course, all children are whiny at some point, but it's when we see patterns or trends of, okay, they're in distress, they need help, what do they do? That's really what we're looking at. Do they accept care from others? Can they give care to others? Do they know who they are? Do they have any, are they able to kind of identify their needs and then use their voice to get their needs met? Those are the things we're really looking for.
What about things we hear a lot about, the importance of making eye contact and things such as that? How important do you think that is as a sign, not importance by in and of itself, but as a sign for a child that may be struggling with more significant attachment issues?
Yeah, you may see things like the inability to make eye contact, kind of turning away or not liking touch. Uh-huh. So, you know, they wipe their kisses off, they pull away from hugs,
become rigid,
don't want to be rocked.
Yeah, divorce, yes. And becoming rigid when you're trying to give them comfort or affection.
Right. They don't know how to accept it. You'll also see oftentimes just kind of a hypervigilance where they're kind of always on alert. I mean, you can see it because they startle easy, and they may just be dysregulated easily.
Mm-hmm. And have a hard time getting back into regulation once dysregulated.
Yes, their coping skills. That's one of the things, you know, that first year of life is so important when we're talking about building relationships and for regulation, is because when your need is met and your body is just, you know, distressed and dysregulated and you're crying, and then a caregiver comes to comfort you, your nervous system is learning how to regulate itself. Your brain is learning how to regulate itself. It's like, I'm distressed, now I'm comforted. I'm distressed, now I'm comforted. And we were talking about that happening thousands and thousands and thousands of times. And so that's kind of the how attachment sets the stage for regulation. And so when you don't have a healthy attachment, then oftentimes regulation becomes a real issue.
So I think in terms of attachment is falling along a spectrum from, it's not a black or white, whether you either are attached or you are not attached. It's more of a spectrum issue. So from mild to severe, the issues could be either from mild to severe. So could you describe some of the typical behaviors that might appear along the spectrum? And if you want, go ahead and begin with healthy, strong attachment and then walk us along the spectrum to help us understand some of the distinctions between how attachment issues can progress.
Yeah, so sometimes I think of attachment on a continuum, and because I have my researcher hat on, I think of it kind of in terms of classifications. So I think of secure attachment kind of in the middle. And then if you go out to the left, I think of, anxious, avoidant attachment. And if you go out to the right, I kind of think of anxious, ambivalent attachment. And so when I think about secure attachment, the behaviors that you'll see are they're comfortable accepting affection, they're comfortable asking for help, they tend to get along with their peers, they have good social competence, they have a voice, they can recognize their needs. I mean, simple things like knowing when they're thirsty or hungry or cold or lonely, you know, those become more advanced, but you want to start with the simple things. And then, so understanding their needs and then understanding how to get their needs met. And then when you move to the left to the more anxious, avoidant attachment, the behaviors that you'll notice would be things like, taking care of stress on their own. So instead of turning to people to get their needs met, like, you know, I dropped this bus on my toe, you know, help me. It's okay, I'm going to figure it out on my own. So maybe I turn towards other things for comfort other than people or my caregivers. So I might turn towards toys, or I might turn towards food, or comforting in another way other than relying on my caregiver. You'll see additional behaviors kind of on that part of the continuum would be they children might tend to be withdrawn. They might seem really independent and try to take care of everything themselves.
So if you move to the right, ambivalent attachment, what does that look like?
That looks like trying to keep the caregiver's attention. So maybe seeming clingy or needy, being really behaviorally dysregulated, kind of temper tantrums, crying. They might be easily upset. They may have a low tolerance for frustration. They might seek help even when they don't need it. So I used to be an elementary school teacher, and these were the kids that were always at my desk asking for help even when they were capable of doing it themselves. They might seem emotionally kind of volatile. You don't know when they're going to erupt.
Mm-hmm. Or what will set them off.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the important things is that all three of those kind of attachment styles are organized, so they have ways of dealing with distress. What we see with children who have had abuse or neglect or in more kind of dire circumstances is their behaviors, they become disorganized in their attachment where they don't have any clear patterns. And so this is where you see the extreme behaviors. You see their behavior is chaotic. It may seem really unpredictable. They may escalate really quick. They may, in adolescence, they may have, like, you know, lie to you even when you just saw them. So kind of really bizarre type things. They are highly, highly, highly attuned to nonverbal cues. So looking, and they might not understand all of the verbal, nonverbal cues. So they may see your face and think that you look angry when you really look sad. But they pay a lot of attention to nonverbal cues. It's one of their survival strategies.
And I'm glad you mentioned survival strategy, because very often the behaviors we see, even the most annoying ones, are actually survival strategies. They have worked in some way, or this child's perception is that they have worked in some way to protect them.
Right. These are actually adaptive behaviors. Mm-hmm. They've kept them alive.
Exactly. And hence why they're not easily extinguished, because they are important behaviors. And it helps to understand the why, because that influences how you approach it.
That's one of the things. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. That's one. Go ahead. Say it. I'd want to hear it.
I was going to say that was one of the biggest aha moments that we would have when we were doing the Hope Connection Camp, is that if we could get parents and professionals to change their viewpoint from looking at children's behavior as survival strategies, as, you know, as opposed to manipulation or control or being willfully disobedient, that's the turning point. Mm-hmm. And they have build compassion.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Then you become compassionate to what this child is going through, as opposed to just annoyed by their behavior,
right?
Which is a reflection of what they're going through. Exactly. We hear a lot about reactive attachment disorder, and RAD is what it's called. It's all over. When you read anything at all about adoption or fostering, you will quickly come across the word RAD, the acronym RAD, reactive attachment disorder. Where does that fit in the continuum, the spectrum that you've just described, which is organized in three different categories and then completely disorganized? What is reactive attachment disorder, and how common is it?
I don't know the exact how common it is. I can tell reactive attachment disorder. I can tell you that disorganized attachment is in a typical sample is about, you know, anywhere from 5 to 15% of children. But when you look at a maltreated sample, it's about 80% or above.
Wow.
And so when you look at a sample who has experienced abuse or trauma or neglect, then disorganized attachment is, you know, typically more than 80% of those children are disorganized in their attachment. And so I think the biggest thing that I've seen is that in order to help these children, it takes adults who have the self-awareness to kind of have processed their own attachment in order to be able to help a child move towards a secure attachment.
Mm-hmm. And so it takes an adult who is willing to, as you say, be able to also see the whys of the behavior as opposed to just the behavior. That's what you're
right. Mm-hmm. Being able to understand what is that need. Sometimes parents will say, oh, they're doing it for attention. Okay, well then let's figure out, you know, what is that need? How do we meet that need in a more proactive way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we have people contacting us with worries after just a few weeks of the child being in their home or their family. Mm-hmm. And the family and the child are both in the midst of adjusting to a total upheaval of everything. And they are concerned that their child has reactive attachment disorder or will never be able to attach. And their concerns are real. But what is a reasonable amount of time to give a child before parents begin to want to diagnose an attachment issue?
Dr. Purvis used to recommend 1 month per year of a child's life. So if a child comes to you at 3, then 3 months of intense intervention, not just life as normal, but of intense intervention with that child. And then if you're still seeing, you know, I mean, obviously it's not going to be perfect, but if you're still seeing really troublesome behaviors, then that would be a time to seek additional help. So, but one of the things that she also recommended was when you bring a child home, you have to start over from that first year that, you know, the Erikson psychosocial stages of building trust. And so we have to be able to, when we first bring a child home, is to meet those needs, whether they're 10 or 2, you know, it's going to look a lot different to meet the needs of a 10-year-old than it is a 2-year-old or a 2-month-old. And so it's giving, she used to say it was giving yeses. It's investment parenting. We're putting those yeses in the bank. That's why she was the queen of bubblegum at camp, because she could say, do you want a piece of bubblegum? Yes. I mean, the first second that she would meet a child, and she was getting lots of yeses in the bank, and that's how we build trust. And so sometimes we would challenge, parents to pick a day and have a day of yeses where, you know, it's not spending money on things, but it's spending your time on things. You know, yes, I'll go play soccer with you. Yes, we can go on a walk. Yes, we can play this game. Yes, we can, you know, do Barbies for 4 hours or whatever it is, mm-hmm. but to really give those yeses and try to build that trust and meet those needs in a really proactive way.
It sounds exactly like her. I'm smiling at the bubblegum thing. That I can absolutely imagine. So what are some other things that parents of newly adopted or foster kids could do to help their kids attach? Finding ways to say yes, finding ways to meet their needs, two really good beginnings. What are some other things?
We talk about engagement, and you and I mentioned this earlier about healthy touch, eye contact, making sure the tone of your voice is doesn't sound harsh or mean when you're being playful, right? Really be paying attention to matching the child. We call it behavioral matching. But if they're, you know, if they choose a red ball at the store or, you know, a red cupcake, you choose a red cupcake too. So you're just trying to find ways to explicitly connect with them as far as, you know, finding things that you have in common, but then also implicitly through, you know, healthy touch, eye contact, the tone of voice. Being playful cannot be emphasized enough. It is so important because when we're playful with children, that disarms their fear and allows them to be in a place where they can learn and feel safe.
And when you mean being playful, do you specifically mean to be playing games, or do you mean, in addition to that, a playful attitude of things, or what do you mean specifically by that?
Yeah, I think a playful attitude is more rather than jumping straight to correction. So for example, if a child rolls their eyes or gives you a sassy, you know, tone of voice or, you know, demands something, responding in a playful manner. So, you know, saying, oh, are you asking or telling? Or can you try that again? Or, oh my gosh, I don't believe what my ears have heard, or, you know, mm-hmm. something like that, rather than going, what did you just, you know, starting on a lecture or, you know, going down the path of structure when nurture might be better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So those are some things, some tips for newly adopted, or for actually for all children, whether or not they're newly adopted or not, but those are some really good. So you talked about the fact that children who have come to us at a later age, or who have experienced abuse or neglect, or have just had their whole life disrupted because they have been removed and placed in our home, that intensive work is often helpful from the beginning. In fact, you were saying that the time period for which one needs to allocate for a child to adjust really starts at the time that we are giving, we're being intentional on our work with that child. But when we reach the point where we think that a child needs therapy, particularly therapy to help them attach, what type of therapy is effective for kids with attachment issues?
So I think any type of therapy that is relationship focused, TheraPlay is a good example. TheraPlay is different than regular play therapy because it is led by the therapist. And it focuses kind of on four dimensions. So there's structure, nurture, engagement, and challenge. And the therapist will lead the activities with the child, with themselves, or with the child and the parent. And they can assess, you know, which of those areas are the parent's strengths, which of the areas are areas for improvement between the child and the parent. And then they can prescribe, or they set up the sessions to, you know, to work on those areas for improvement. So for example, if a parent is really good at nurture and has a problem with engaging with the child, then they might have some games set up where they worked on the engagement strategy.
Okay, so TheraPlay is one, and I would say that TBRI, therapists that have gone through training, trust-based relational training, TBRI training, are also, I think, particularly well-suited. And actually, just any adoption-competent therapist, I think, can usually be working on these issues. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think that any, you know, of course, TBRI, trust-based relational intervention, is a great framework for therapists, but it's not specifically an intervention. But so I think any intervention that's really working on relationship skills and regulation skills and creating a safe place for both the parent and the child, I think is really important. It can help kind of recreate that attachment cycle.
We talked some about regressing, and you alluded to this at one point just a bit ago, the need to meet the child and perhaps even regress so that you're able to regress the child so that you're able to meet some earlier needs of attachment. How does that work? I mean, it's one thing if you're talking about a 1-year-old, it's another thing mm-hmm. if you're talking about a 10-year-old. So how does this work?
So that's a really good question. I think one of the ways when you're connecting, you have to figure out how do I connect with this child, whether they're 10 or 2 or, you know, 6 months. And so it's figuring out how to find, like, so for, let me just give an example. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble coming up with words.
Been there, so done that. I understand.
Yes. Yeah, so for a 10-year-old, they're probably not going to get in your lap and let you rock them and read a book to them, right? So other ways that you might connect with them might be throwing the football. It might be taking the dogs for a walk. It may be playing a board game, playing hide and seek, doing an art project together. Things that they're interested in. I know with my son, he's 14, but he loves for me to watch him play his video game. Uh-huh. You know, it's So it's finding things that they're interested in and doing that. We have had some, some children that we've worked with who are 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 who do want to be rocked, who do want to be held, who do want to kind of go back and get some of the things that they were missing, especially if they have a younger sibling that comes into the family and they see that child start to get that kind of care as a baby or a younger child. And so I think it's just being open to kind of seeing where those needs are and figuring out ways to connect in really meaningful ways and really being present, I think is the key. We talk a lot about mindfulness, and I think it's the parent being attuned and being able to be really present is really one of the most important things.
Mm-hmm. Let me pause now to remind people that this show, as well as all the many resources that we provide at Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support of our partners. And these are agencies that believe in our mission of providing and supporting pre- and post-adoption and pre- and post-fostering all families. One such partner is Spence Chapin. They are a licensed and accredited nonprofit organization in the New York City metro area that has been offering adoption services for more than 100 years. They have a robust, and I do mean robust, post-adoption service provider. They provide these services for birth parents, adoptive parents, and adoptees. We also have Hopscotch Adoption. They are a Hague-accredited international adoption agency, placing children from Armenia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Georgia, Guyana, Ghana, Morocco, Pakistan, Serbia, Ukraine, and they also specialize in the placement of kids with Down syndrome and other special needs. And they also do kinship adoptions, international kinship adoptions. So please keep these agencies in mind. They believe in education, they believe in support, and they put their money where their mouth is. So one of the things that we hear a lot is the confusion between, I think that a lot of people assume that attachment parenting means giving the child whatever they want. And they don't understand that discipline is also a part of this. And Dr. Purvis and I have talked about this in the past a number of times, and that attachment parenting is absolutely possible to discipline while at the same time focusing on attachment. So how do you recommend parents go about having standards and having behavioral expectations at the same time, that how is that not competitive with the idea of forming attachment?
Yeah, we get that question a lot with TBRI. Mm-hmm. And one of the most common errors that we see when organizations or agencies start using TBRI is that if they've been very high on structure previously, that they kind of err going the opposite direction and become really high on nurture and kind of let the structure go away. And then they're like, well, this doesn't work. And mm-hmm. TBRI doesn't work and all the rules have gone out. And what about consequences and all of these types
of
things?
Yes, so, we hear it all the time.
Yes. And so what TBRI, that we talk about the balance of nurture and structure, and both are equally important. Dr. Purvis used to say, if you give a child nurture when they need structure, you inhibit their ability to grow. And if you give a child structure when they need nurture, you inhibit their ability to trust. And that's one of the lines that's always stayed with me, because I think it's so important. We have to have, when we talk about parenting styles, we talk about authoritative parenting, and that is what we're going for. We're going for that balance of nurture and structure where we have expectations. We demand respect. We have the expectations for respectful behavior, but we also have the nurture.
Mm-hmm. And I do think it is so important. And I think that it empowers parents, because one of the things that they are hesitant about is, opening up the gates and having, children have no rules, no boundaries. And so they think that they can't do attachment parenting because they can't focus on attachment because, I've got too many kids, or, this child will just take over. And that's not part of it. Can you give us one or two techniques for a child, let's say, who is misbehaving, has done something which you have asked them not to do? Okay, let me give you an example. We're walking down the, before you've gone to the grocery store, you've said we're not going to be getting toys. But you go near the toy aisle or whatever, the cheap toys that they have, and the child starts pitching a fit because they want a toy. So can you give, in this, I'm asking you to do it spontaneously, but can you give us an example of how one could handle that situation where the child is, you're still expecting behavior, but you're also not focusing on attachment?
Right. It's hard to just give a straight answer because I want to say, okay, so have we been proactive? Have we set the child up for success before we went to the grocery store?
No, that's
a
good
point.
Hey,
here are the things that we're going to the store. Help me come up with a list. What kind of cereal do you want? What do you want for breakfast this week? What do you want in your lunch? And we've got to be proactive in setting up the transition to the store. And then when we're at the store, and then we might put the expectation really clear. Okay, when we get to the store, you are responsible for getting these things. We're not buying toys today, right? So we're setting the expectation really clear. And then when you get to the store and you're at the toys and they're like, I want this truck. And you're like, remember what we talked about? We're not going to get that. Can you go get the Cinnamon Toast Crunch that you picked out? Let's go see if we can find that. So it might work, it may not work. If it doesn't work, then you may have to, step up the structure a little bit. And if you can't distract them with something else, you may have to offer choices or say, okay, well, we're not going to get a toy. So would you like to go find the macaroni and cheese or the yogurt next? Do you want to ride in the cart or would you like to hold my hand and walk next to me? Mm-hmm. We might have to up the structure a little bit by giving some choices. Some of my worst parenting moments have happened in the grocery store.
Mine too. Yes,
so
absolutely.
Stressful and everyone's watching.
Everyone's watching and you're trying to
That's
be efficient.
Right.
You don't want to abandon because it means you have to come back to the store. So you're
right,
wanting
exactly.
to get through and you're, and you're under, Yep.
So I think being proactive is one of the big things about TBRI is really setting kids up for transitions and for success. And when we talk about the balance of structure and nurture, we also have to keep in mind raising and lowering the bar. And what are our expectations at this moment? So has the child had, are they hungry? Did they sleep well last night? Have they had a big transition in their life? What's going on with them right now? So what's their daily history? And then what's their life history? Maybe the grocery store is a trigger for them. Maybe a certain food is a trigger for them or a person that they walk by in the store. So we have to raise and lower our expectations based on where they are.
Yeah, that's good advice. We need to also talk. We spend a lot of time talking about children and their ability to attach to us. I feel like we spend far too little time talking about us and as parents, our ability to attach to our children. And I think it's changing and we are speaking more about the importance of parental attachment. But it's one of our blogs that we did many, many, many years ago, and it still is one that we get probably one of the most hits and comments on. And it was a parent. I think the title is something like, I feel like a beast, but I don't love my adopted child, or something along those lines. And it's very poignant. And this is a parent who is not an evil person, but she is really struggling with feeling love is how she described it, but another way of feeling connected to her child. So let's talk some about parental attachment. I think it's self-obvious, but I'll ask it. Why is it important for parents to also feel these feelings towards their towards the feelings of bonding towards their child?
Yeah, it is so important. Attachment is a reciprocal relationship. And so when we're thinking about, when we're talking to parents about attachment, one of the things that we ask them to do is to think about what are they bringing to this interaction with their child. Are they bringing a calm presence? Are they bringing awareness of what we just talked about, of the child's history, of their, of, you know, where they currently are? Are they able to respond flexibly, respond in a flexible way? Are they able to come up with creative solutions? Or are they blocked by their own history? Are they blocked by their own trauma? Are they blocked because they have nothing left to give, right? Self-care is so important as well, making sure that their tank is full so that they can give that to their child. I think we talk about that a lot, about what is the parent bringing to the relationship. When you think about attachment, about 80% of the time, people will have the same attachment that their grandparents had. And so attachment is really robust and reliable, and it doesn't change, you know, easily. It doesn't change unless you have, I think they're called corrective emotional relationships. So if you have someone who comes in who is that, who provides that model for what healthy relationships look like, or going the other way, if you have some sort of a trauma or loss or something that happens that kind of leads your attachment in the opposite direction that you'd like.
You know, another thing that, and all those are really very valid reasons or things that will interfere with the parent's ability to attach to their child. But you know, another one that I see a lot of is unrealistic expectations that parents come in without a firm understanding of how this child's behavior may be, or the stress that this child may bring into their life. And do you see that as well? It just seems like one of the things that we could so actively do as people who care about kids and as a profession who's trying to make certain that adoptions and foster relationships are successful, is to help parents form realistic expectations before the child even enters their home.
Mm-hmm. I think that is really important, the pre-adoption support. What I've heard from many people who are in that field is that they do that, but at the time, they're trying to give parents a realistic expectation of what's going on, but at the time, the parent isn't open for that information.
Yep.
A lot of times because they don't think they'll need it.
Well, it's almost, you go into this optimistically. Yeah. You believe it's not going to happen to me. And we often, as educators, will often roll our eyes at that. But the truth is, there's nothing wrong with being to approaching life in general, and certainly a parenting decision, I mean, the choice to take a child on through fostering or adopting, with an optimistic attitude. And so it is a challenge to set realistic expectations because people don't think it's going to happen to them.
Right. I think that's where the post-adoption support is so important, because
exactly.
Then when the wheels do start to fall off, we can say, okay, this isn't going to be the first time you've heard this, but maybe it's going to be the first time that you're going to, you know, listen and take something with you. I always give this example to parents that when there's always disorganization before organization. And so when you're thinking about, like, In any system. So when a child's starting to walk, they might have sleep disruptions or food disruptions, because when one area of development is kind of growing, some of the other ones kind of regress. And I think of it like cleaning out your closet. So when you clean out your closet, you make this huge giant mess first before you reorganize it. And that's how family systems work. So.
Yeah, that's actually a good way. And you know, one of the reasons that we encourage families, all the online courses at Creating a Family, are we want you to download them. We want you to have them permanently, because we strongly encourage people, and we actually know that people do this all the time, that after they take the course, because it's a pre-adoption requirement, but they come back to the course when they're, okay, my child is doing this, or my child is hoarding food or whatever. And let me go back and remember, in the field, we call it educable moment. The educable moment is when you're looking at this child and you're wanting to wring their little necks, and you're thinking, okay, wait, I know there's a better way to respond. And that's when people are then reaching out and they're ready for information then. So you're exactly right. That's why post-adoption is so important. So what are some things that you would recommend for a parent to do if they are struggling to attach to their child?
One is to practice self-care and make sure that they're not so spent that they don't have anything to give. So whether that's, you know, taking a few minutes to do something that they want to do, making sure that they're getting enough sleep, that they're eating, you know, on regular times, that they're managing their stress in healthy ways. I think it's important that they have relationships, you know, with a partner or with a friend or family member where they feel safe. I think that's really important. Making sense of their past is another way to increase or to, you know, build healthy attachments, because once they are able to kind of know where they're coming from within the relationship, I think then they can be more present within the relationship. I think parents can, you know, obviously seek help from mental health professionals or from, you know, your organization, from other places that are resources. I think sometimes just hearing that they're not alone, so joining mm-hmm. a support group, that way those types of things can be helpful.
All of those, and feeling not alone is huge. So joining us in person or an online support group is really amazingly helpful. It normalizes what you are going through. Let me ask, I mean, one of the things that we often parents are told is that when they a child is new in their home, they really need to be the primary person taking care of the child. They need to have not leave the child. They need to be with that child as much as possible in order to create attachment. But some self-care also requires you to have time with a friend or your partner. It requires perhaps you to if a self-care thing for you is going to yoga, it requires you to be able to, you know, get out 2 times a week to go to yoga, that type of thing. Can you talk about that balance? I think that parents hear mixed messages from mm-hmm. professionals as to, and that balance is very hard for them, the self-care and the focusing on spending time with their child.
Yeah, it is very tricky. We hear from parents about this all the time. And I think the most important thing is that they're in a healthy place so they can help the child kind of build that roadmap for healthy relationships and for healthy regulation. And if they're not in a good place, I always say that, like, I'm a really good parent, you know, when I've had I've had healthy meals, when I've had enough sleep, when mm-hmm. my stress isn't out of control, when I've been, this. Mm-hmm. And when do all of those things align? Like 2% of my life, right? I'm going to try to find, okay, so what is the minimum number of sleep I can get? What do I need to do? And if we're going to be the healthiest that we can be, we are going to have to find, carve out time and space in order to do that. I think one of the misnomers about attachment is that you have to meet every need every time. Mm-hmm. And that's impossible. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to be good enough parents. We have to meet their needs on a consistent basis, but that doesn't mean every single need every single time. Right. And other people can meet their needs as well and show them what healthy relationships look like with other safe people. And that's a transferable skill. And so I think parents need to give themselves a break and yeah. really work on taking care of themselves, because mm-hmm. in the end, it helps them to be a better caregiver.
I couldn't agree with you more. We do want you to spend time with your child, but you also need to spend time with yourself, and if you're in a relationship with your spouse or your partner, because that's important too. And you just can't keep pouring and pouring and pouring all of yourself into others. That's number one, it's not feasible. It's number two, it's not sustainable. And you're also not setting a good example for your children, because that's not sustainable for them either. So all of those are important. I do think it's important when we're talking about the parental attachment to at least touch on post-adoption depression and acknowledge that it is real and it absolutely can impact, well, impacts every aspect of your life, but it certainly, including your attachment to your child and your general enjoyment of life in general as well. So what can parents, first of all, how would they know they have what is post-adoption depression, and then what can they do?
I think it is common because our expectations sometimes don't, most of the time, don't agree with our reality of what we've been expecting. And this could be, you know, oftentimes when people are going through adoption, it could have been, you know, in the process for many years.
Yes.
And so you've had all of this time to build up these expectations and this life of what it's going to look like. And then when reality comes, it looks way different. And so your expectations and your reality aren't matched. And so I think some of the signs for depression are, they can show up in different ways in different people, but it can be, if you, you know, sadness, irritability, it can be withdrawing from people, overeating, undereating, kind of not being excited about things that you used to be excited about. My advice on that would be, one, I think a support group could be really helpful, because you're not going to be the only, you know, many, many, many families are going through the same feeling. And then I think mental health support through a counselor or a therapist would also be helpful.
Thank you so much, Dr. Casey Call, for being with us today to talk about attachment 101. We really appreciate your time and your expertise. Let me remind everyone that the information presented in this podcast are the views of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that this information is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your adoption or foster care professional. Thank you, everyone, and we will see you next week.